Our program to bring you this important message.
What's up, buddy?
What's going on?
Nothing much. Hey, I want everybody to listen to this voice here. I'll tell you who he is here in just a second. We got linked up through a mutual friend who's also a guest on the show. This is kind of that example of the power of the internet, the power of the ability of people in different parts of the country who kind of have the same mindset of just wanting to try to do something positive and something good for people to link up. And the guest I've got today, we did just that. We had about an hour long conversation one day, if not longer. And we realized we got a lot to talk about and people got a lot to listen. And the best part about it, have a lot to learn in a really good way about life decisions, life choices, gangs, subculture, prison life, like all of it, you know? So I want to hand it over a little bit here to Eric, let him start talking and kind of walk you through what life was like for him and what his ultimate life choice change was. And then we'll move it backwards and you'll get to hear more about his life.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on. My name is Eric Hebert and I live in Arizona and I grew up here in Kankakee, Illinois a little bit, but I kind of wanted to start off with what got me out of gang life. And in 2012, I had caught a case while I was in prison for assisting a criminal syndicate and money laundering. And my mom subsequently also got arrested in this this thing. It was just her and I. We were co-defendants. And I had got transferred from prison to the county jail. And one day at court, when I was walking, I seen my mom. I was with the men. She was with the ladies in a line, all shackled up in stripes, handcuffs, and it broke my heart. I knew that she was there due to my gang activity and decisions that I had made. And right then and there, I just kind of made a choice to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people that I've encountered at some point in their life, they hit kind of what I call that breaking point. And oftentimes it's the human side of us, that heart, that our soul, which is oftentimes the person that raised us, a family member, whomever it is. But it's often seeing that their actions directly affected a loved one. And this is probably one of the worst situations or scenarios next to getting killed in some act of violence, a loved one, but to have to watch, you know, your mother being locked up and knowing what those days hold for her. And I want to take a chance here to just tell everybody, our conversations are oftentimes very easy to have, especially like with me and Eric. Like we can talk very openly. I want people to kind of understand too, this is a huge step for a lot of people who are trying to do really good things in their life and then openly talk to an audience and tell them about some stuff. And and this is going to be multi-parts. So the good news is, as listeners, you're going to hear each episode, you'll hear different sections of Eric's life because he has transitioned through multiple subcultures and gang life, prison life. So I just kind of want everybody to know that it can be tough sometimes to open up and talk about this stuff. And I just appreciate you coming on, man. And like I said, you've got a lot of stuff moving forward that you may be able to talk about, maybe not, maybe you hold it until you're ready to go. But you have the capabilities to do a lot of really, really cool stuff that I think a lot of people are going to be really excited about. And your level of knowledge and experience, people, listeners that are just citizens living about their daily life, can learn from it. And then officers, agents, deputies can learn a lot from it and we'll talk more about like just the human side of life and building rapport and being good to people. And then on that other aspect of maybe some young listeners who hear this and kind of realize, maybe I don't want to go down that path. Mm-hmm. Because I can sit there and say it all day long. Their family members can say it. Maybe even they got a friend. It's like, hey, don't. Like basically like don't get brought home blood, don't get recruited in the crypt, like whatever it is. But guys sometimes and girls too, it's like I want this lifestyle and they want to join it. And sometimes it takes somebody who's been there to kind of explain this is the pitfall, this is the recruiting tactic, or you know, this was at least my experience. And with that being said, can we take it back in your life to when you were young or younger and you got exposed to like the first bit of your gang life or your gang experience?
Okay. So I really don't remember a whole lot of my young childhood until I was maybe about 10 or 11. That's when I really start remembering things. And I believe the reason why, I lived in Arizona at the time. I was born in Kankakee, Illinois. My mom brought us out here to Arizona the first time in 1985. In 1984, I was 5 years old. I started going to kindergarten school here, which I sort of remember. I have like vague memories of that. But my mom kind of moved around back and forth. She was never really stable. So I ended up having a little sister when we were 8 years apart. So I must have been 8 when she was born. And when I was about 10 or 11, I was started getting in trouble in school and got put on probation. And my mom sent me away to Illinois to go live with my sister to go, you know, try to straighten me out, my older sister. And that's when I really remember, like, just kind of being on my own, sort of free. I started listening to music a lot. Got me a little Walkman and I would just cruise around the town and, you know, walk around. There was really nothing to do. I went to a school that was, it was 85% black. And that was kind of a culture shock for me coming from Arizona to there. And I was like a little stoner kid. I had long hair. And, so I started getting bullied by black people, honestly. Like it was racism. Like it was, mm-hmm. you know, I've been on both sides of that. And so sorry, you might have to edit this part. What was the question?
Yeah, no, you're good. You're good. It was basically like that early experience. And I think you were kind of getting there of like, when you first got exposed to any kind of criminal gang life.
So I don't want to say it was a criminal gang life when I was 11, but I pretty much was, this was before I left it to Illinois, actually. My mom was hanging out with a lot of bikers. And so there was always like a lot of those type of people at the house drinking, doing coke, smoking weed. And I just didn't want to be around the house, so I would just take off, run the streets. And I think that's really how I got exposed to the streets in general, was just not being watched. And then, do you want me to talk specifically about the Satan Disciples?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, jump, yeah.
Okay, so then, because I have to bounce around a little bit then.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay,
yeah.
So when I was really young, when I was about 11 years old, I started to get into trouble out here in Arizona. And my mom, I got put on probation. I went to juvie a couple times. And my mom was just like, I don't know what to do with them. I don't know what to do with them. So she sent me back to Illinois. I went back to Illinois for about a school year. And I had a lot of trouble. I was getting into fights with people. I was a little long-haired white kid, so they were calling me Erica, this, and that. So I was getting into a lot of fights with black kids, and I just wasn't really feeling that. So I called my mom. I was like, I want to come back home. I came back home, and about when I was 14 years old, I got a girl pregnant and I had a kid on the way. So my mom decided that she didn't like my girlfriend at the time. She thought that she probably wasn't the mother of, or that I wasn't the father of the kid and all this stuff. So mm-hmm. she just up and moved me about 1 month before my kid was born back to Illinois. So I was really distraught, really upset about that, fighting with my mom. I kind of hated my mom. I'd run away from home all the time. And then she ended up just kind of leaving from Illinois. I stayed with my sister. She tried her best to control me and, you know, keep me in school and get me to do the right thing. But I ultimately just left the streets. I lived in a little town called Aroma Park, Illinois. And there was a growing small set of Satan disciples coming up out there. They were a sanctioned crew from Chicago, from 24th and Lithuanica. So, I mean, I grew up in that culture listening to Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and Eazy-E and Bone Thugs and Harmony and all that kind of stuff. So it was just that whole gangster mentality in my town was very, like, it was trendy. And especially for the kids, that the fatherless kids that were running around, they had nothing to do. So a group of Satan disciples approached me when I was probably, I want to say I was 14, almost 15 years old. And I started hanging out with them, smoking weed, drinking. We were doing home invasions, robbing cars, getting into fights with Latin Kings, you know, just all the normal kid shit, going around tagging. So I ended up getting arrested for a home invasion, went and did some juvenile time and just furthered my gang activity in there.
Yeah. And for the listeners, when Eric's talking about Satan disciples, some people have no clue about gang life, and others listening have worked, you know, FBI RICO investigations and stuff. Satan disciples, for everybody, goes back many, many decades. So you go back and look in Chicago, and this is a multi-state gang now, with multiple sections of chapters spread throughout the Midwest and a lot of the southern states along the East Coast. From North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, at Mississippi and Alabama, Tennessee, right off the top of my head, I know have presence of Satan disciples, as well as some of your other Midwestern areas. But when you go back and look at this gang throughout the time in Chicago, historically, they fell under that Folk Nation Alliance. And so for a lot of people, especially in southern states that are only experiencing these national gangs for probably the last 20 to 25 years, people were getting a lot of stuff confused, you know, and they would see maybe a symbol and go, oh, that's a folk gang and this is what they are. And it's kind of, I have to tell people, you know, Folk Nation is basically an alliance that was formed in 1978, but it was of existing gangs. And one of those is Satan Disciples. Some of the other gangs in that alliance will be like Gangster Disciples, you know, Maniac Latin Disciples. So, but when we stick with Satan Disciples in Chicago, some of what people were experiencing even back in the 70s was kind of what is now historically referred to as those sweater wars. And so when I talk about that, people are like, what do you mean by the sweater wars? And so it's interesting for us now in this era to go back and look at what some of the early members looked like. And this was a gang, you know, that was formed, but at the time we're wearing these sweaters. And if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple or any of the other platforms, we'll also have this up as a YouTube video. The podcast itself has a YouTube channel. I'm starting to get a little more involved in it and I'll put different things up, but we're looking right now, listeners, at a picture of early Satan Disciple members, and they're wearing these sweaters that are like knit sweaters, and they have patches on the front, and the patch actually identifies the gang. And so here's Saint Disciples, probably in the late 70s here, I would say. And we're looking at two members who are wearing these sweaters, but they're also, one guy is throwing what we call like a pitchfork hand sign. And he's putting it up, and it's basically your index finger and your thumb kind of make what looks like a U, and then your middle finger goes through the middle of that. So if you're looking at it on here, you can see it. And one of the things I always like to tell people, hand signs and gangs didn't just start in the last, you know, few decades. Like, it's been around for a very, very long time. And so when you're looking at like this picture, Eric, I know it's you know, an older picture, but does that look pretty legit to you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and your era would have been obviously after this, you know.
Actually heard of these guys too.
Oh, you have?
Oh yeah.
Okay. And for the viewers and listeners, the picture we're looking at actually has some stuff written on like a banner in the background. But what does that mean to you, Eric, when you look at that banner?
Well, I mean, you got the two guys there. You got Bird and Mouse. That's going to be their street names. And you got the 23rd and Oakley. That's the streets that this particular set is on. I believe. Is there a 23rd? I know there's a 19th in Oakley, but
yeah,
23rd in Oakley. Yeah. That sounds right. And then you got the pitchforks and yeah.
And so for everybody listening, when we're talking about like 23rd and Oakley or different intersections or even different kind of identifiers, so everybody understands when we say Satan Disciples, it's actually Satan Disciple Nation because it's so large now. And whereas like Bloods and Crips break down into sets, Latin Kings break down into like tribes, like, you know, smaller groups within the organization. In Satan Disciples, it kind of breaks down to what, Eric? Like what's like kind of the name of the smaller groups?
So, I mean, it's the same thing. You have sets. Mm-hmm. You'll have a set, which will be, then you'll also have chapters, which could be regions. So you'll have things on the north side of Chicago, which may be one region. The south side of Chicago, maybe another region. But a lot of the suburbs, like I lived in Kankakee, Illinois. So we were under the chapter that was from, you know, from the south side of Chicago, 24th Street. And so then it's just kind of sanctioned down from there, but it all goes top up. I'm trying to think who was the top guy back when I was in, he was in prison. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, no, I was just saying like that. So that's an older picture there. And then this one is older, but this is a great example of they're still kind of sporting the sweaters. Mm-hmm. But the guys we're looking at the picture on the right actually has that crown piece or like that flag or, you know, what some citizens would call a bandana. Most people call it a flag or, you know, it's a bandana wrapped up a very certain way and put on his head. And then, you know, as the game begins to transition through the 80s and 90s and getting into a lot more of the drug trade and violence, that's probably where we could probably trace it spreading out too, you know, through population shifts, people moving out of Chicago, bringing that gang with them, especially if they hold a little bit of rank, they go to a new area, they start to recruit and kind of build that chapter, that region up. We also in the South will see people will get arrested and go to prison. And then when they get to prison, they link up and meet up with people who are in a gang. And then they get brought home or you know, like recruited into that gang. Then they get out of prison. They return back to their home city or whatever, their county. And they come back as that, for this example, like a Satan Disciple. Mm-hmm. So that's how this gang is able to spread now with social media. In my experience, we've had not specifically with Satan Disciples, but with some of our blood sets on the East Coast, we have active gang members and sets connecting with other people just through social media and then recruiting them. And then you have a young teenager or a young adult from, you know, a 20-minute drive from a city, driving into the city to link up, get jumped in, you know, actually be stamped official, and it's all through social media, you know, so it continues to spread. It's one of those things that I think is very, very hard for, you know, younger people to resist if they are in fact already getting in trouble, already associated or meeting people that are in the gang, and it makes it a little bit easier to kind of join. And so one of those things that comes along with that are tattoos. And I always teach, like, not all gangs are exactly the same. Everybody kind of has their own little culture within a gang, signs, symbols. Chicago has always had a lot of symbols tied into their gangs, and they have a lot of gangs. So we just said, you know, Satan Disciples, they utilize pitchforks. In this example, this will be an example of a tattoo in which you've got that Satan Disciple head, which is like a smaller devil head with these horns for the listeners. And then in between the eyes on the forehead is actually a pitchfork on this tattoo. Is this pretty standard here, symbol here? Yeah.
Very standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times, even in the tagging, sometimes you'll just see horns. You may not even see the full devil face.
Yeah. And when we're talking about like graffiti and stuff, this piece here I just threw up is a very elaborate one. You've got the devil head up, pitchforks up. S and D are actually written out on the wall in pretty big letters. In the Chicago world and that gangland, you've got, anytime you invert or flip upside down a rival gang, it shows disrespect. So a lot of times cities go through different kind of shifts where a gang is present. They're putting up a lot of graffiti, and it's basically to show a presence, send a message, that sort of thing. And then other cities, gangs are like, hey, we're not putting up graffiti, we're not doing that, or it just kind of falls out of style or whatever. We're still seeing it a lot in the South, a lot of graffiti, a lot of pieces like that. So with that being said, when you got in, was there anything that you had to do in order to get in, or was it basically you just kind of are hanging out with people and they just accept you for who you are and vouch for you?
No. No, I mean, my particular crew that I was in was because there's a lot of fake people running around. There's a lot mm-hmm. of unsanctioned gangsters running around. And back when I was younger at the time, the Satan Disciples were primarily a white and Latino gang. Mm-hmm. There was some blacks in it, but so we had to take either a 1 minute beat down with no cover up where you could fight back, or we had to take a 3 minute beat down with cover up where you could cover your head, your body or whatever. And you'd take that. So I took the 1 minute fighting back and got the shit pummeled out of me. I don't know if I landed like one punch, but I got the shit out of me, by some bigger kids too. They were 16, 17. One of them was one of my friends, and he didn't take it easy on me. He told me he wasn't going to. So, got through that. And then from there, I mean, it was just, we were required to, it was actually very organized. And there was these older kids, they were maybe 18, 19, they had graduated high school. They were on a fire crew in a suburb of Illinois. So, I mean, they were big, yoked up white boys, like, and they had guns. They were versed in robbing people, they had the blue light. So we would pull people over. We'd be in the back of a truck laying underneath the I had the thing that shuts down the back of the truck. Mm-hmm. And these guys would be up front with vests on, dressed up, like pulling people over. And then we'd jump out and rob all these people, you know, like they were targeted attacks. But, mm-hmm. I mean, looking back on it, that was the one thing I was always really impressed with. And mm-hmm. back there, they don't call them gangs. They call them organizations. I'm not in a gang. Mm-hmm. I'm in an organization. That was all the thing. So that was kind of something that we were, you know, we were proud of. But, I mean, we did it all, you know. I never killed anybody, but, you know, like, people mm-hmm. got shot at, you know, people got shot, people got stabbed, doors got kicked in, all that stuff. So,
yeah, it's...
Yeah, we had dues that we had to pay to we had meetings we had to go to and dues we had to pay every month or every biweekly maybe to the organization.
Mm-hmm. And so that brings me to a point that I always teach in class. because everyone wants to know how gangs operate. And like we just said, it depends on what group, what their city of origin is, and what their history is. And so
Their leaders are in that particular set, because you might get somebody that's a piece of shit drug addict that's all about themselves, you know, and then you might get somebody that's really a hardcore militant person that really wants the change they're talking about. So
yeah, it's crazy, because like you and I have talked a little bit, we know one another a little bit, but everything you're saying is exactly what I teach for all these different gangs. And it's pay attention to dues, because any gang that charges dues is going to be able to spread very, very quickly. And it depends on leadership, like you said. So if leadership is very, very selfish, and they're charging dues and their subordinates are charging dues, then when the subordinates get in trouble and get locked up, or they need help financially, part of paying those dues are supposed to be paid back sometimes to take care of the subordinates. That's kind of the sales pitch. But as the money flows up, if the leadership is corrupt, like in any business, any organization in society, and any government, you know, we can study it in history, that when that occurs, those leaders take more than what they're supposed to. And they can either get violated way up the chain for doing that, or they do it, no repercussions for them, but the subordinates suffer because they have to pay the dues and nobody's taking care of them. It also can explain how you can have a spike in any kind of burglaries or crimes where members can't afford to pay the dues. If the dues are a little too exorbitant or a little too much, and this has been my experience, where you'll start to see car break-ins in a neighborhood or a certain, you know, district of the city, and you're like, you know, what in the world's going on? And then maybe a week or two later, you got an informant who's like, yeah, you got about three dudes who can't pay their dues at our universe or at our meeting or whatever. And that's your crew breaking in. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and also depending on the organization, but if middle management gets to take a cut of those dues, the more people they bring in, the more money gets paid in this kind of violent Ponzi scheme. So it's that idea that I always explain to other departments and agencies and stuff. When you're debriefing people and when you're trying to get a hold of whatever criminal organization you're working, the most important, one of the important things you can find out is, do they actually have to pay dues?
Yep.
And if they do, start to really focus on that, because the motivation is to expand, you know, rapidly. That also brings me to leadership. Like you said, you can have people who are very, very charismatic and can make a organization very solid, and they can discipline their people and do just what you said, use tactics. Dudes are out there reading The Art of War, The Five Rings, like they're studying warfare. I've actually had a crypt source tell me, hey, you know about Operation Anaconda? And he was actually referring to one of the conventional military operations in Afghanistan that also had special operations components. But when he said it, it let me know he was studying warfare. He was applying it in our city to movements that they wanted to do against rival blood sets. So I tell people, like, just like you said, supervisors and upper management in a criminal organization can sometimes dictate whether the city's going to have a little bit of peace or whether they're going to have a whole lot of violence. And I know regionally, Saint Disciples have been involved in murders and that sort of thing. Like you said, just like any other organization. So for you, when you were in, and you said you took the jump and you took the beating, even though you could swing back, but you got pummeled. What did it feel like after that beating, once the fist stopped and the feet and all that, like what happened and what did it feel like?
I mean, everybody picked me up, hugged me. We drank some beer, smoked some weed. And, I mean, I don't really remember exactly, you know, what transpired after that, but it was great, you know, and then it was great. And it made me feel empowered. It made me feel like I belong somewhere.
Yeah. Honestly. I asked that just because it's like that rite of passage, like as human beings. And I don't always get so hung up on gender because a lot more women or girls are joining gangs and putting in work and getting jumped in. But this idea that we all kind of want to belong. And for some people, it's the military. And so that's what I equate it to, is that when I was in the Army, when you made rank, they beat it into your collar, like blood rank, or any of your wings or special skill badges and stuff like that. But it's this idea that you're being physically tested and you pass.
Yep.
And when you said, like, everybody picks you up, they hug you, you smoke and drink together, I would imagine that's a little on like the addictive side. Like it's, you now crave it to a sense, you know. And I do always worry about once people get in, like that's the really pivotal time, because a lot of times they're willing to do just about anything for their family now, you know.
Right.
And that's sometimes where a really, really terrible leader can ask a new member, or usually juveniles or teenagers, to go out there and do acts of violence and that sort of thing.
Right.
So for you, when you got in and now, you know, you're a member and you're rolling around and you're doing stuff with them, did it seem to be like it was growing and expanding, or was it more just a collective, like tight knit crew?
So, I mean, it was definitely growing and expanding at the time. It was pretty short lived with me because I ended up going to juvenile prison relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the gang. I was probably 15 years old, maybe 50. Mm-hmm. I think I was about, it was right after my son was born out here. So yeah, I would have been 15 years old when I joined in. And then within that first year, I ended up getting sent away to a camp. I went to a camp in Illinois and Canada for 3 months. Half of it was in Southern Illinois, half of it was in Canada. And it was me and 12 other boys. Most of them were gang members. And so I went there. They tried to straighten me out. I resisted it. I did very well in the program. But there was this one Latin king in the program, and I'm not going to say his name. I ended up running into the dude in juvenile. He's a super fucking cool dude, but just naturally we had beef, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, the counselors, just like when you get locked up, they kind of make you put your beef aside with the people that you have on the streets. You get along. But, you know, I was just a young, dumb kid, and it's like, well, this dude's a Latin king, so we're supposed to be going at it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this dude was the best athlete in the whole fucking program. Like I was number two to this guy for everything. Right. So I guess I just developed a jealousy. Like I just couldn't, you know, so I kind of was really petty, started fighting with this kid. I got my ass whooped by this kid 3 times in the course of this 3 months, you know, mm-hmm. and one time I even hit him in the back of the head and he still whooped my ass. So I was like, that's just kind of the kid I was. Like, I just was like, I didn't want to take a loss, you know?
Yeah.
So I go through that program and I did really good. And then I went back to the streets, and I always wanted to run away from home because I didn't like my mom, because my mom was an alcoholic, and I fought with her a lot. So I took off and I ended up doing a home invasion in a small town, and me and two other guys kicked in this door, did this home invasion. I can't even remember how we got caught, but me and one other dude got caught. That dude told on me, and then I went and got locked up for about a year and a half. So when you go into juvenile prison, they sentence you till you're 18. So they take you and they say, all right, you're here till you're 18. And then they'll give you a recommended time of how long you're supposed to be in there. They gave me 9 months. I think I ended up staying a little bit over a year. In that time, my little sister had passed away. I had she was 8 years old at the time. My mom lived in Florida, and she was riding a horse and fell off the horse, hit her head. So my mom had to pull the plug. While I was in juvenile, my family came and, you know, they gave me this news. And then I got out maybe a few months after that. And my mom, when I got out, the day I got out, my mom said, we're going back to Arizona. So we left, and that's pretty much how I got out of the SDs. Like, I just came back here. There's not an SD set out here. I just didn't stay in contact anymore. And then, you know, then we can go into the other stuff because.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, that was kind of how I went through that whole thing. And I just left and really never contacted anybody ever again. And
I forgot
my tattoos later in prison. And, you know.
Yeah. Are you talking about your SD tattoos?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna come back to tattoos and what sometimes when people are getting what it means. But when you were talking about moving and then moving back to Arizona where there's not a presence where you were moving to.
Right.
For a lot of people, like, that's one of those things where every organization is different. And people will say, there's no way out. You can't get out. And I always tell, like, citizens, whether it's church groups I'm talking to, you know, foster parent programs, hospital staff, whoever I'm presenting to, it's like people can get out, but there are steps involved. And one of the easiest, fastest, quickest ways is I used to tell guys, like, you got to find a relative that lives somewhere out in the country. And when I say that, people are like, you sound like you're in the country, but yeah, I am Southern, but I did grow up in a city. But, right. You know, I tell them, like, you got to find a relative that lives somewhere where you can move, have a base of operation where they let you sleep on a couch or do whatever for a week or two, three, until you can get a job or find something there to make ends meet. And you're basically just falling back and you're, you know, you don't even have to tell the gang or the set or whatever that you're leaving. You just kind of make it slowly start to happen. And it's a little harder to come back to the meetings and, you know, and then some organizations, like the old term was like laying your flag down. Like, hey,
yeah,
we'll let them leave or some will say he's leaving on good terms. Or he's leaving good. And they'll allow that. One of the trends that we see a lot in the South, people will hop from or what we call pancake or flip from one gang. Yeah. Flip from one gang to another. And so did you see some of that going on? Like when you were in SD, like were people doing some of that?
I never really experienced, like, I mean, I've heard of those people, but yeah. My circle, I think everybody was, who knows, they're probably still doing that shit, you know, like some of the people back home are, they've never changed. They've never ever changed. So, yeah. But no, it happens. Experience a lot of my own crew, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of strange for me too. This is another thing that people may not understand about gangs. Like, so the gang originated out of Chicago, right? So like all the top dogs are in Chicago. So if you're not from the city and you're in juvenile, then you're kind of like, or even probably in prison, it's kind of like, well, whatever, you're not, you know, there's always just kind of that air, like you're not really, you know, from the city or whatever, you're not. So it's almost like it's not real.
Mm-hmm. And
every gang involvement I've ever had is I've always kind of felt like it's not real, or it was hard for me because like I came up under you know, somebody from the suburbs. So it just didn't have a lot of clout. That set didn't have a lot of clout, though it did. Like our set was actually pretty strong. But, you know, not as strong as ones in Chicago. So I always kind of felt that like insecurity, like I didn't belong there anyway. And that really, I mean, that's something I don't think people really talk about. So when I went, like I had the big dogs in there. So they have everything kind of separated by your age when you're in juvenile. So they have like 12 and 13 year olds over here, whatever. So the big dogs, you know, they were 16, 17 years old. And so like even those guys, you know, they you know, like they kind of talk shit to me a little bit, but I mean, it's part of the hazing thing too, you know? So I don't know. That's just another thing I think is it's difficult to maneuver in some because even in the gang, everybody doesn't look at you like you're in the gang, you know, like it's not, it's not really a united front. Like everybody wants to make it sound like, oh, this is the nation. These are all my bros. And it's not really like that.
That's a good point. Like we talk about, like all organizations are similar in that sense. Yes. There's always a formal hierarchy, and then there's that informal hierarchy. So people, whatever, are a supervisor of some sort, and the workers are like, that person's a jackass. I don't like him. He doesn't know the job. You know, he hasn't put in the sweat equity that I have, or she hasn't, or whatever. And it's the same thing in that world, like you're talking about. Also, did you ever see like anyone making rank or moving up that because they did it? They did it because they were related to someone, like maybe like that, or like, yeah.
Yeah. Not so much in this, but in the other stuff.
In the other stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things, before we get off of SD, like the whole tattoo thing.
Yeah.
Is there a rite of passage or a thing that you have to do and specifically for these tattoos, or is it just, hey, I want to get this tattoo and I'm going to get it?
Yeah, I know that when I got my tattoo when I was in juvenile, and I had to fight a Latin King. So,
okay.
And I had to whoop the Latin King too. I couldn't get whooped by him because that too, you know, like you don't win them all.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
I had to do that in there, even though like I had paperwork, I had everything sanctioned from the streets. Like I knew all my literature. That's do they still do that? Spit your lit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it was, yeah.
Yeah. So when Eric's talking about that, these organizations again are just like in the private sector, just like in the military. You have to know the codes of conduct, the lingo, the actual rank structure, the proper terms for it. You got to know your chain of command. You got to know what, you know, for certain sets or certain chapters, like what the pitchfork means. Does each point mean this? Does it mean that? And they have to know all this stuff. And so for many, they get checked on it. Like you said, like spit your lit, or, you know, like, for Bloods, it'll be like, hey, we would check your wood or your Inglewood. You know what I mean? Like, we got to know what you know. And that's also a way to galvanize people. So if there's this entire secret society of hand signs, symbols, lingo that no one else knows about, there's a lot of power in that. And there's a lot of conditioning involved. And it's the same way in the military and MOSs and different job titles that people that are infantry may be for have problems with someone in a different job. And then everybody's trying to say like, who's the toughest or who's the most hardcore or whatever. But then also you have your policies and your tactics and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then that, a lot of that gets, you know, kind of brought into the gang life and adopted and stuff. So when you talk about that, you know, early on, my experience was everybody had to have their lit on their person. So that's why I would always tell people like, hey, when you're searching, dudes are going to have stuff in their pocket. It's just going to be basically like a folded up piece of paper. And it won't matter to you as an officer or deputy, but that piece of paper, they have to memorize things on that. And a lot of times there's a lot of information on that paper. And when you look at it, it might not look like anything to you. It may just be like, I don't get it. I don't know it. But then the paper versions became digital. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of sets or a lot of gangs were putting stuff digitally and putting it in their phones, putting it in their laptops. And the whole idea was enough cases have been prosecuted where they found out or they learned that departments and agencies had their literature, had their paperwork, their PW, you know, and it's like, hey, we're leaving this stuff around. We've got it on our person. We're getting searched for weed or drugs or guns. We got it digital. Let's do that. Well, then it was making it really, really easy to do phone extractions and computer extractions. Yeah. And then, so then they switch again. And what I tell people is like, compare it to how Al-Qaeda was operating. Yep. They were using phones, you know, communicating, and then drone strikes, and people were keying in on those phones. And then they said, no more phones. We're going back to human courier. We're now going to transmit messages by way of, I'm going to tell a person this. They're going to go to a different area and tell the person that. People can say whatever they want to, whether that's good or bad in an organization. My thing is, know both forms exist. Know that a paper form can exist. Know that digital formatting can exist. And that it matters. Like, knowing all of that matters. Knowing for deputies, agents, officers, if you're doing really good work and you're trying to get as many people out of the gang as you can and prioritizing the most violent offenders, and that's who you're going to focus on, and you're also going to try to develop sources to cooperate, you can't walk into a room or walk, you know, meet them in the cut, however your approach is, and talk to someone and then say, basically, I want you to put your life in my hands and I don't know anything about your organization. You mm-hmm. have to know a lot of times more about the organization than the person you're approaching does.
Yep.
So that they can understand you care enough about your job and about the community that you're willing to learn this. And how did you learn it? Oh, you learned it from our brothers and sisters who were talking, you know. And it's that idea, like you said, of the organization can become so powerful if its own members truly believe and are willing to live and die by it. Or are people understanding, hey, maybe I don't need to keep down this path. Like, it's not good for me. It's not good for my family life. It's not good for anybody. You know, citizens can get hit by stray bullets, that sort of thing. So you were in and then you moved away and you kind of got a different environment than what you were in before. So then you move back to Arizona after you'd served some time, right? So what was it like once you got back and settled down into Arizona?
I mean, it was cool. Like, I came out here, I was staying with my mom had a friend from Illinois, and that's how we actually ended up out here. They moved out here in the 80s, and it was her best friend. We moved back out here with them. And then I got a job. And so I had my kid already, right? But my girl that had the kid, she was already married with some other dude after I had went to juvenile. But they had broke up right before I got out. So then I came back out here. I ended up getting back with her. Like, everything was cool, but I was just young. I was just young, and I didn't know, like, I didn't have any job history. Like, I didn't grow up with a dad, so I didn't really know how to do shit. I just gangbanged. I sold weed, you know, I robbed. That's how I always got money. I didn't, that's what I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came out here, I tried to get a job. It was a little bit difficult because I had the juvenile record. And you had to disclose all that at the time. I don't know if you even have to do that anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, I think most states have gotten away from that, as well as raised their arrestable age to 18 and above. Yeah.
Right. So and then my mom left, you know, so it was just kind of like I just went right. I ended up just going right back to the streets ultimately, because that's all that I knew. So it was good for like a year, and then it wasn't.
So. Yeah. So when you were doing that, and you bring up a good point too, that and some people can't think outside of their own perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look at it and they're just like, it's almost like they want to just discard anybody and everybody who doesn't do exactly what they do in life. Like, they didn't, you know, have a job at 16 or 18 years old, or some people will look down on people who don't have a college degree. Or some people that were in the military will look down and call everybody civilians, you know, and just be like, no one can compare to me or my unit or what I did, and everybody else is basically beneath me. I think probably for most people to understand, it can probably feel insurmountable. I can't get over this, you know, now that I'm out, I'm trying to get a job. And you brought up a good point about, like not growing up without a father and not having maybe someone who says, I'm going to teach you and show you exactly what a job interview looks like and how to almost, it sounds terrible, but like sell yourself to the person you're interviewing for.
Right.
Know? Like that is a, that's probably one of the more important things that if I was in charge of schools for a day, I would have at least a quarter of the year on one class that kids could take that would be completely geared towards how to get a job, how to do a job interview, how to understand that your first job is usually at, you know, 16, 18 years old is like entry level, but that's not where you're going to be your entire life. Potentially you can get on, you can move up, you can learn trades, you know,
right.
And I'm getting off on a tangent, but man, I can remember being a kid and being in high school and the focus was get everybody in college. And I just didn't come from that world. I didn't know a whole lot of people that went to college. Most of my people, my family and relatives and friends were working. They got jobs, they worked, or they knew a trade. And, you know, so things like that, that I do think people are losing perspective that even if it's not your kid, you know, like on patrol, I would see barbers and barbershops doing a lot of mentoring to young men coming in and getting their haircut and trying to explain to them that world out there, those streets are going to eat you alive. You may be top for right now, or you may get out there and your name's known in the street, but you're not going to make it to my age, young man, you know, and these are barbers that are, you know, 30 years old, but they're considered like old men on the block because of that, you know? So I do say, who knows, man? Who knows what your path would have been had a lot of this stuff been different for you and had somebody put their arm around you and just been like, hey, look, everything you've done to this moment has been forgiven. Nobody's holding it against you. You are a new person now, and reinvent yourself. What is it that you want to do and how we're going to get you there? You know, and what are your interests? I don't know. It just seems like it's a way to kind of redefine success for each individual, not the collective, not what maybe a school system tells us or what society says that your success is how much money you make per year or level of college degrees or rank in the military or whatever. It's, you know, every individual is different. And
right.
And that's my thing is like, I, when you're telling me these things, I'm picturing you in this stage in life and adults walking around and seeing you and any adult can do this. Any adult can stop what they're doing and talk to someone for a few minutes sometimes and it make a huge impact.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's what I just recently this has only been in the past maybe 6 months that I've really come to realize what it was I needed and where, you know, so, and it's because I have a kid and mm-hmm. I'm watching, I'm like, okay, my kid's going to be 9 next week on Monday. And I'm like, holy shit. I was locked up when I was 11. We have almost 14 year old in the house and an 11 year old in the house. I have a soon to be stepkid. So it's like, that's what's really just opened my eyes to all of this and go, holy shit. Like what is going on? You know, mm-hmm. how did that happen? And I don't want to go back and blame anybody, but it's like you said, it's taking that second. And there was people that intervened. There was judges, mm-hmm. there was probation officers and things like that. But I really can honestly look back and say that they never did it the right way. You know, mm-hmm. they're looking at a snapshot of you and based, you know, so it's just, and if you grow up without two parents, especially if you grow up without a father and you grow up with somebody that's just an alcoholic and all their mm-hmm. friends are alcoholics, that's all you see. That's all that's around you. So that's the only opportunity that you really know about, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you see. So, and I don't know where I was going with that, but it's very, very eye-opening.
Yeah, you had said that they kind of did it. You said they did it the wrong way. Which that's what I mean is like, we have to learn things and do things differently. But when we change things and how we do it, we want to base it on logic and what, how do we know this approach doesn't work?
Right.
Well, this is how we know it doesn't work. 'Cause now people are adults and they're saying, hey, you know, yeah, I have to own some of my actions, but also, you know, it's the same as when you're just asking someone simply to do something. If you walk up and you tell them, hey, you go grab that bucket, you know, or if you just say, hey, can you do me a favor? You're not picking up that bucket for me and bringing it over to me. Most people be like, oh yeah, complete stranger. Yeah, I'll get the bucket for you. But I think in the judicial system, there's this idea of that. And I hope a lot of it is changing in different facets. I've done everything I can to try to help people see a different perspective, working gangs, working homicides and stuff like that. It's like, but you know, the kind of compassionate side, firm, compassionate, and these are the consequences. But also, if I tell you when you're getting out of juvenile lockup, and I've had to pick up one of my buddies getting released from a juvenile prison when I was a kid, you know, borrow my mom's car, go pick him up. And same thing, it was home invasions. But it was this idea of, you know, now what? The same person that's either a judge or even sometimes the arresting officer, detective, or whatever can say, this is where you messed up. And yes, society is, you know, this is the way it is. You're going to prison. But when you get out, like it's supposed to be a new line, like a new way of life. And if you need something, you let me know. Like, this is the deal. Or when you get out, these are some programs that you can check out. These are some jobs where I can guarantee you when you walk in, the boss man or the person that works there that interviews you has probably either been through a very similar situation and worked their way up or created their own company. Or like one of the guys I've got, and I know, he walked in and when he interviewed for a car dealing or a car detailing job, and the guy who hired him told him, I'm hiring you knowing you got a criminal record, knowing you got felonies, but I want to help break this cycle. So if you come to work every day, you're dependable, and you're someone that I want to keep on, the next person I interview and hire will be someone coming out of prison with felony background. And we're going to keep this thing going, and we're going to help people break this cycle. But if you screw up, if you don't show up on time, if you shortcut, if you don't give me 110%, I will never hire another person with a criminal record. And so that dude told me, he said, man, at that moment, it switched. Yeah. This was not a job that I kind of like cars, so I'll car detail for a while. He's like, I now had a purpose. And the next person he hires who has a criminal record, I can explain to him, I know what it's like being locked up. I know the deal, but also this is a way out. This is what we do. That same guy, eventually after several years left and started his own car detailing business and started hiring people. Yeah. So it's like that idea of, you know, every now and then someone gets it right. And I do hope that a lot of that system is changing. When I talked about raising the age, and for some people, they may have been like, what, you know, arrestable age, meaning that in some states, you could be 16 years old, you know, several years ago, and police could pull up, see you do something. It could be, you know, smoking marijuana, trespassing, whatever, assault charge, whatever, put handcuffs on you and take you to the county jail. And a lot of people had studied it and said, hey, we've got to break this cycle. You know, this is not good for kids. Juveniles could still be charged with other criminal charges, but it was a different type of process. It went through the juvenile system, and you couldn't just go, like, you just couldn't just go up and snatch up a 15-year-old just because they were trespassing and cuff them and take them to a jail. But a lot of states throughout the last probably 10 years raised that age to 18. So basically, police officers couldn't just roll up and physically arrest a 16, 17-year-old anymore. One of the things that we're seeing, and I say we in the law enforcement world, is, and we knew it was going to kind of happen when they changed it, is this spike in violent crimes.
Yeah.
And so what you're seeing is the spread of gangs have been going on for a long time. We talked about that. Coupled with juveniles joining gangs, coupled with, oh, it's all over the news. Everybody's reposting it. They can't just walk up and arrest you at 16 and 17. And they hear their own, you know, big homies or higher ranking guys telling them, yeah, in my day, they scoop you up right off the block, cuff you up, and then call, you know, whoever's taking care of you, your guardian, and let them know you at the jail. So the younger generation it was almost like a free for all.
Yeah.
So right now, you know, a lot of areas that have raised that age in the last few years are still seeing that huge spike in violent crime. Now I hope that levels off for the kid's sake and for the victim's sake, right? But it's that double-edged sword, man. Like, you don't want to send, young teenagers whose frontal lobe of their brain is still developing and they're still in a state of day-to-day survival mode. They're not thinking, my actions today, carrying this gun or kicking this door in or whatever it is, will affect me down the road, or that I may actually get sentenced to live life in a prison for X number of years. And I don't know what the answer is to that. I just know that we as a society, we do have to make sure whatever we're moving towards, that we're using logic and reason, compassion, but also a firmness in the sense of depend on the experts that are in that field. And you and I, brother, are experts. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing that...
We'll get off on it later, but just to speak to this particular topic, when I was 18 is when I got... I was two weeks after I turned 18, I caught this case, and I ultimately got sentenced to 18 years, right? Mm-hmm. So now we know... Or most people accept that the frontal lobe is not fully developed until you're 25 years old, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we all accept that, right? I believe that in a court of law that would be acceptable, but still we charge people as adults when they're 16, 17 years old, or you sentence an 18-year-old to some extravagant amount of time. And again, I don't know the answer either, because I believe that there does need to be punishment. There does need to be prisons. But let's take my situation, okay? I'm 18. I go in there. We'll get off later into what happened, but it didn't rehabilitate me. I can say that. And I'm not trying to play the victim, because the opportunity for rehabilitation really isn't super present in the prisons with all of the politics that go on with the prisons, with the gangs and all of that. So, now how you and I kind of got introduced to each other was through a person that emerged that I knew through a case that happened out here. Mm-hmm. And now we have seven kids sitting, looking at first degree murder for jumping on a kid. He got killed at a Halloween party, and, you know, they range from 17 to 20 years old. And they're looking at felony murder because there was a kidnapping, and so they got him for first degree murder. Now, you have the public here like, hang him. And then I'm sitting here, and that's the only reason I'm even talking on these things, is because I'm kind of like, holy shit, somebody killed a kid. And holy shit, those kids are just like I was when I was a kid, like just out doing stupid stuff, looking for violence, and it, like, so I go, okay, now I look at myself and I go, should I have been thrown away for life? I didn't get thrown away for life. Like, should these kids be, what's going to happen to them when they go in there? What's the plan? You know? Mm-hmm. So I would just like to see some type of reform in that sense, where you don't let people get off the hook, but prison just houses people. There is some rehabilitation in some places, and there is people that come out, but overall, they're just housing people, which is creating more gangs. It's creating more violence. It's creating, you know, criminals that's criminal college. Mm-hmm. So So it's kind of, it's just, I feel like we're at a point where, what are we doing? What is the, something has to change, or else we're just going to continue to see this cycle go on and on and on.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And it's a good slowing down segment for this chapter in your life. And you kind of alluded to what we're going to talk about in future episodes. And then topics like this, you know, as we get feedback moving forward, if you're listening, do me a favor, shoot me some questions. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, put it in the comments below. Ask us questions of topics that you would even want us to cover in future episodes, be it, you know, juvenile rehabilitation, prison rehabilitation, anything like that. We'll get into all of that. I think Eric and I both have level heads now. We're old heads, so to speak. So we can kind of talk on different topics, and this is the way it's supposed to be. People are supposed to be able to talk and act civilized. And if you disagree, that's cool. We can still show respect, mutual respect. And in our worlds, that's what it's always been. You treat me with respect, I treat you with respect. You know, I'm not going to do you wrong, you don't do me wrong, and we're good to go. So if you're listening, though, reach out to me on the disruptors.bc.ski@gmail.com, and I'll answer any questions, coordinate with you. Eric, do you have any way that people can contact you, or are you kind of on hold right now for that?
Yeah, I'm on hold. So I think we're going to do another episode, and I'll have some more info for you.
But
great lineup. I'm starting a podcast next week. And so I'll be out here. You'll hopefully be on my show so I can ask you some questions, because I got a lot of questions.
yeah. Now, do you want to talk about and segue about your podcast, or you want to wait and then talk about it? Or do you want me to, do you want to go ahead and tell people kind of what the premise of it is?
Yeah, we can go ahead and talk now. So I'm coming out with a podcast. It's called Change Gang. And everybody that comes on the podcast is going to be somebody that wants to see a change in the world, right? So, I mean, this could be people that, like, for instance, you are an ex-police officer, and, you know, I'm an ex-gang member, so it's, but we kind of have a common goal to see people come together, to see that bridge get gap between, or the gap get bridged between the community and, you know, the institutions and the authorities, and just kind of like, you know, get everybody on the same page and make a safer place for our teens and our kids and everybody. But so I'm going to be interviewing people that are like you. I have a couple other guys that were on FBI task force. I have some community leaders. I have a 501(c) that was formed that I'm going to interview them regarding the teen violence stuff going on out here and some changes that we're trying to make to local politics, hopefully world politics. So, yeah.
Good deal. Hey, before we wrap up, is there anything like music recommendations where you're like, look, y'all, if you're having a rough day, a bad day, like check out this artist, this band, this song, whatever. Is there anything like that you dig that still kind of keeps you motivated?
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of music. So I have, you know, I listen to everything. Right now I'm in a rap phase. I love like Yellow Wolf and stuff like that. But I would say one of my favorite artists is this guy named Caskey. And he's a rapper out of Orlando, Florida. He recently did an album a couple years ago with Yellow Wolf. And this kid, like, he's maybe 30 years old, slung down, completely tattooed. And his father killed himself when he was 16 years old. And so he talks a lot about, you know, like his pain growing up, and like he was involved with gangs and drugs and all that type of stuff. And he's recently got married. He wants to have a kid. Have you heard of Wes Watson before?
I have not.
You've never heard of? Okay, so Wes Watson is this guy. You got to look him up, but he's a motivational speaker. and he was in California prison. He was, I think he did some time in Pelican Bay or whatever. And he got out. He's a motivational speaker, workout guy. And he got a hold of Caskey, and because Caskey was like really bad on drugs and shit like that. So he's like, look, man, you need to get on this program. So he had him like doing burpees and eating right, and like just got his whole mind right. So Caskey's kind of became a good artist, I think, for the younger kids, because he's been through it and he talks about it, and he's like shown how he comes out of it. He has a very positive message. He's been through some real pain coming home, seeing his dad's head blown off when he came to school, you know? And so, yeah.
Yeah.
I would recommend his music. I'm a big lyric guy. And I'm a big story guy too. Like, I really appreciate the real shit that people have been through. So yeah. I would highly recommend him as an artist.
Good deal. Good deal. Yeah. Well, Eric, I appreciate you coming on. We'll have future episodes where we'll talk about more chapters in your life and more organizations and that sort of thing in prison life. And then whatever else comes, you know, if there's more topics, whatever we got going on. So I appreciate your time, buddy. We're going to wrap up. It's Disruptors out.